As always, I'm glad you're here. Glad you came. You give up, you know, you give up part of your day, especially a nice evening like this, to be here. That's, I do appreciate that, and hope it's worth your time. We're getting into a section here that I find interesting because it's stuff that I know about. I mean, I grew up with, so that makes it more exciting. Maybe not so much for. I put on the board over there on the end there, I mean, it's kind of small. I just, the time we're in is a significant time now from all kinds of aspects. So I put the stuff on the board over here, and I thought about people that are in ministry today. So I took myself and Gil and put ourselves up. I think he was born in 43. Is that right? Yeah. So I'm not 6 years older than he is. I am 5.5 years older than he is, or something like that. So I was born in 37. So now I have a brother who's born in 43, but in November. So I always get mixed up how this works. So anyway, so the people that we grew up under, ministry-wise, I would call first-generation people that came out of this period. So we're the first generation away from it, although in some sense, not fully first generation, because I remember some of these people like Carl McIntyre and John R. Rice. And these people would know them only by listening to Clear Channel Radio out of Mexico. That's one of them, XCRF. Yes. So in that sense, as a kid driving down the road, the only entertainment we had in our cars was AM radio, and we were lucky to have that. So these names come up, and I remember hearing them preaching and got acquainted with some of these people through that. So in some sense, they're part of my life or my reference point. And so, and that would be Gil, too. He's a little younger than I am, but he has an advantage about knowing this. For one thing, he's a lot smarter than I am. That's a great advantage. He doesn't forget a thing. And the second thing, he grew up on the East Coast where this was mostly happening. So I mean, he would come to me and ask, well, you know about so-and-so? I said, well, no, I don't know about them. But they're famous people in the East Coast, but not here. The Midwest is the flyover district it was then. I think it was the Stagecoach drive-through district then. So now it's become the flyover district. So anyway, these are kind of interesting times for me to study. And probably don't know that much about it, you know, as an observer. Growing up in high school, had no interest in, I don't know, frankly, what I was interested in high school. I guess getting out, I think that was what it was. But, well, she was there, yeah, she was a year behind. I had to wait to get her, get educated. So I would say my high school days are kind of funny because Wanda was a salutatorian in her class, and I graduated. So in the bottom half of the class. But I didn't have any motivation to do what I do now, so, and I'm not sure, let's not get into that. So anyway, these are interesting times for me personally to study, and I hope that they are interesting for you. And for some of you are my age too. Pete, you're even older than I am, so you know these guys. You're from more from the Midwest, Chicago area. Bobby and I might have known these people better even than I did. Again, I wasn't paying attention to them. They just were in my orbit. And the church we went to would have been an evangelical church, but it wouldn't have had those kind of people ever in. We're a little, you know, backwater place in Henderson, Nebraska. No one would come that would be famous to speak to us, except one of the criminals that got saved under Billy Graham's ministry was in our church in Henderson one Sunday morning. So I remember him because he had white wingtip shoes. white and brown wingtip shoes. Yeah, so they'll be back in style someday. All right, what else am I going to tell you? That little chart just shows you that we're kind of close to the generation that lived through the things we're going to talk about today. Well, my dad was born in 12, so he would have been 12 years old, 13 years old when the Scopes trial occurred, but I don't even know he was aware of it, you know, that kind of thing, so. And Bill was asking whether there's a book on the Scopes trial. I assume there was. I don't have a book on the Scopes trial, but I imagine there is, although it would be difficult to rely on it very much because, as we'll see tonight, there's so much bad news out of it or warped reporting out of it that you'd probably read a book and wouldn't be, you'd have the, inherit the Wynn style of reporting, which was not very well done. So you wouldn't probably know much after you're done. So I guess you got to come to my class. All right. So I just want to show you these pictures because they're so good. These pictures are from a 100-year-old paper almost. You know, these are Brian. I could say Brian. And we have Will Osborne over here. These are pictures of the newspaper. And his testimony is that whole page you see on the right. Plus it went on for about a half a page. So that's a lot of closing argument statement. You'd think you'd read all that to a jury, which he didn't get to deliver. So interesting stuff. Anyway, if you want to see it, you can ask me and I'll show it to you. Okay, this is what's on the board here. We have these color, sections in color. I'm going to go through these in this order. I kind of put it at a crossroads idea. These are the times when ideas clashed, people clashed, things changed. I remember when I taught this back in 9, I had a picture of train wrecks on the screen because this kind of has been a train wreck in a way. So let's just get on to it. So unity since the Reformation regarding the authority of Scripture pretty well was unified. I mentioned this before. They didn't necessarily agree on all the theological points, but where the Bible stood in relationship to authority, it was pretty well agreed. Now, they wouldn't have been able to defend it to the level perhaps we could, but in a general sense, we agreed to that. They agreed to it. But it was being threatened. Now, these, remember, these takes, this doesn't get happen one day, the next day it's over. You know, these takes decades, and in this case, even over 100 years before the effect of these ideas finally permeate the churches and get into the pews. You know, people have to be trained in seminaries, staff, pastoral staff changes over, and finally the new ideas come into the pulpit. So it takes a while for this all to happen. So we have the spirit of criticism or skepticism regarding the word that's coming up, and it just slowly, insidiously increases. Remember Schleiermacher is where it started. We're going to mention another one. Wellhausen is also another German guy that comes along and kicks the Bible down the road into the ditch further after Schleiermacher. So in the meantime, we have these commonly held moral values, and we find out that those moral values end up defining Christianity, and it looks like liberal Christianity because it has been stripped out of the death, burial, resurrection of Christ. So we just have a moralism. Today the word for that is values. And we have the legacy of Henry Ward Beecher. It would be around Civil War times, and he sort of was the first person that really was on the other side of the issue. His father, Lyman, would have probably been more evangelical. But his son, Henry, sort of, you know, not sort of, he forsakes the gospel, and that's in the, right on Civil War times, died 1887. So we have a post-millennial idea that things are getting better, and that fits the moralism. We got to do what we can to strip society of its evils, and we get into things like prohibition eventually in the 20s, and we have before that, we've got the Civil War. We get women's suffrage. We also have, you know, protection of women out of prostitution. These kind of organizations are set up by the WCTU. So we have postmillennialism is established and premillennialism now because of the Bible Commerce Movement. People have taken a fresh look at the Bible. I'm talking about the born-again part of the church. And they see a pre-tribulational, premillennial view of the return of Christ in the rapture, and that starts to, you know, fester against each other. So we have one group that's affirming the scriptures, which are the fundamentalists and the fundamentals of Christianity, and being pressed by those that are born again, and then we have the tension building between these two groups. And that continues on to today. So this is really where it starts, and the date I'm going to put up there where it really becomes critical is 1900, because that's where Arno Gabelein, 1899, decides he's going to leave the church and start, I'm not sure he started another church, but leave the mainline churches over as a protest over the liberalism that's in the church. So now we have a leader that's starting to take a public stand. Not everybody agreed with him. There's a lot of criticism about him, and some started to leak out of the mainline churches. So we have the next 25 years, 30 years, this leakage goes on, and that will form what we have down here, the reorganization, the renewal ministry of the fundamentalists. I mentioned Gabelein here is one of the first to call for the separation from churches. His viewpoint remained a ridicule minority position until the middle of the 1920s or 30s, when separation and new church organizations were formed along fundamentalist theological lines. And they'd be dispensational lines. Now, there were some exceptions, but generally they were dispensational, like you and I are pre-trib, pre-mill. They saw the land belong to Israel and returned back to land by the Jews. It's part of the end time scenario. It was in the middle of the 1920s that the underlying unrest or the division broke into the public square with the Scopes Monkey Trial. That's why the Scopes Monkey Trial itself is probably useless, but it does mark a time. And it sort of allowed people to take a side at that time. So some lessons about this trial. I'm going to mention a couple that I think are interesting. I don't call them, maybe it's a tactical error. I get to the end and say this probably all was necessary, but maybe it wasn't. So I'm not sure the error could be avoided. I just call it an error. The error probably is don't campaign to write moral laws. The World Fundamentalist Christian Association, led by Riley, was organized to oppose teaching on evolution and to promote creationism in the public schools. Now, he gave his life to this. I just might mention here, he died in 1947, quite a bitter old man, because it didn't work. It didn't happen. I mean, in a sense, I could say that the evolution stuff might have stopped or been stopped, slowed down, but creation science never was, creationism was never brought back into the schools. And so he ended up being, as typical is, a one-issue man, one-issue campaign. And no one goes with him. What do you do with that? And you finally get bitter and angry in some sense. And his, maybe I'll talk about him later when you get down the road a little bit, because I think this kind of person is what later on the neo-evangelicals will react against. You don't have to have this, bitter people running our churches, you know. So we're going to do a more kinder, gentle approach. Anyway. That's Riley. Remember, he's the one that started Northwest College in Minneapolis, and Billy Graham followed him in that school for as a president for a couple of years before he went to his public ministry as an evangelist. Now, the issue of evolution, the threat may have been overstated in the idea of evolution. Ideas were repulsive because of the advancement of the eugenics activity inherent in natural selection. You know, if natural selection is the way it's going to be, that's how natural selection is going to function. You got to find out. You all realize that somehow the people that aren't well or healthy are going to have to be eliminated. All of a sudden, you think, "But that's grandma." I'm not sure I want to get rid of grandma. She may be sick, but I don't know that I want to get rid of her. So there wasn't all that much enjoyment with evolution as we might think. Now, listen, when we listen to the media, we listen to the teachers, the scholars, you know, they're all for this. But when you get down to the pews, there wasn't all that much excitement about the evolution. So the whole idea of the campaign may be overstated because the whole idea of evolution wasn't all that supported. All right. Now, this is 2009 Wiki's contribution. You could look up hundreds of these probably, maybe not hundreds, but number of these. Did you look up and wonder how many people actually believe in evolution anyway? I mean, today. I mean, we're almost 100 years from the Scopes trial, and on the top here we see the young earth creationists at 31%. That seems like a low number, maybe, but you do have to add into that group the theistic evolutionists, because they at least acknowledge God was involved in what we have. And to me, that is huge. I mean, a theistic evolutionist is a lot closer than one that's just an atheist. So you add those two together, you're at 53%. And I do it a little later, that you weight that, you know, not counting those that don't have an opinion, don't count those people at all because I don't know who they are. Then that percentage goes up to over 60%. So we have a lot of people still in 2009 still believe God somehow is involved in what is here. And the other side is 32% believe that there's a natural process. So maybe it's almost a two-thirds believe in God in some way is involved in creation, and one-third do not. And those numbers pretty well stay alike. They haven't changed a lot, I mean, in percentages and so forth. And maybe we think today, as of 2019, that maybe they have gone up or down for the creationists, and that may be because there has been a great shift in the last few years about this. And of course, you have, compared with weekly attendance in church, the ones that go to church, of course, believe in God and creation a lot more than those that don't. That's a given. So these other studies suggest that evolution does not have as much sway over the people as we are led to believe. Scientists, notwithstanding, don't want to count them. They're off the chart. The media and other intellectuals would have us believe that creationism is dead and gone. So here's my weighted, a 53 and 32. If you weight that, disregarding the 50%, you have a 62 and 38%. Again, a two-thirds, one-third, almost variation. Now, with the relentless hammering on the secular left, the levels remain relatively constant. I mean, we've been hammered from an evolutionary point of view all the time. And still, it doesn't move the needle that much. To answer this, and then you always have this question, the answer to surveys are always taken as largely approximately so. There's no way to eliminate bias on the part of the question writer and the person answering truthfully. Well, would you really honestly say that you didn't believe in God? Well, it depends on who's asking the question, it depends on who's listening, thinking about your mom or your dad. I mean, can you really be honest with yourself? So I really don't think that anybody's probably going to be very fair and honestly answering the question as he really thinks in his heart. With what we can say, what we can say is that given the opportunity to depend on God or deny him, it is quite evident that in the foxholes of life, you deny him there, and that's the real answer. And I always think about the profane language that goes on that evokes God to action, and they don't believe in him, right? But Romans says they do. So these statistics really probably don't mean a lot in terms of what they really believe. So it is a point to ponder exactly what is the threat of evolution and the power that is owned by the God of creation. Is evolution such a threat God can't handle it? And furthermore, lies tend to be discovered in time, and we have a little bit of that with our politics right now. Finally, after 2 years, these two things are starting to come out. He said, eventually, lies don't always get told. Truth doesn't always come out, but usually they do. Somehow, some along the way, it happens. And so that's true about evolution, I think. Now, we cannot protect the skeptic and his erroneous ideas of origin. He may think whatever he thinks about it, or I stop him from embracing atheism. He's going to do what he wants to do. So making him accept creationism, on the other hand, brings him no closer to being rescued from his condemnation. So to some extent, it's a lost cause no matter what you do. Now, this is what you hear, and I want to spend a little bit of time on this. Think about this. The old lament is, if evolution is not taught, a generation or so of children grow up learning very little about evolution and evolutionary theory. Therefore, they're ill-prepared. They're ill-preparing them for the scientific and technological change which will come in the future. And I must ask right away, what is the value, again, of evolution theory? We call it science, quote, quote. They say, not teaching evolution will cripple future science. But what is the scientific value in teaching evolution? Can we think of one truth of science that evolution science brings to the scientist that it can use in his new experimentations? What new law can be derived from the knowledge of evolution? Now, I'm ready to stand here for quite a while to have you answer that question. There's nothing. There's nothing. It's a theory. There's no laws. They can't write. And I always tie this to math. There's nothing they can write about evolution. So we have this comparison. We got our telephone. It has evolved from a hang-up earpiece to an iPhone. And then we have, down the bottom, we have man elevating himself from a monkey to a standing Homo sapien. And no one believes that the same processes are involved in both of these. We all know that, who was the guy that invented the iPhone? I don't know who he is, Steve Jobs, whatever, from Apple, but he's long gone. Actually, the Israelis developed it. So we have intelligence advancing technology, whereas we have accidental advancement of the human being, which is a whole lot more complicated than an iPhone. All right, so I'm asking again, you think about this. What is it? Remember, these kids are going to get crippled if they don't get evolution taught to them. Name one formula that is derived from the fact of evolution. Leona, you're back there. Can you think of one? There is none. There is none. Now remember, if they don't know about evolution, it's going to stymie their growth in science. That means that there's something that they need to know that will advance science. But there's nothing. Unless you answer the right question on the application form, I believe in evolution, therefore you're admitted. Now that might do it. But in terms of science, do evolutionists teach one math based on evolution and creation teach another? What math is used to produce space travel trajectories? So the evolutionary model would be this. There's no evolutionary model. There's only one scientific model, and it's a scientific model that the math is the same. So this math suggests a design purpose. Is not math and creation, are they not related? You can measure things that are created. Is it not reasonable that the source of math and creation are the same? Information creating God, is it not this God, the same God who has created our minds that we can use so that we can comprehend this, the very discussion? How can random chance produce numbers? How can chance produce two? What is two? Unless somebody tells us what two is. And I have the mind to even think what two is. How can two be comprehended or defined without a mind? How can chance produce a math that can only be understood in the mind, which two is a product of random chance? So my mind's a random chance. Two is a random chance. But somehow I understand all this stuff. So I think that what you have with evolution or random choice or selection or randomness, there's really nothing there. There's nothing there. Because you start out with something, they have something that's random. I mean, you have to have something, even dice. Dice are going to be thrown in random, and the numbers come up randomly. Well, then ask who made the dice? Who put the dots on the dice? So all of a sudden, we don't have something random. How to make sure they're not out of balance so they don't always come up the same number? So we have all these things. Nothing lives in random chance. Who made the dots, the dice, the shape, the size, the weights, then make two alike? Only a mind can make or produce something as something that's going to produce random. But you can't get random unless you got something produced to make random. All right, you got it? I'm not done yet. Further, what new formulas were derived from the Big Bang? I remember I did this in 2009, some of this stuff, and I remember that they took, and I asked, what is a minus exponent number mean? Nothing asked you, Leona. Well, the bigger the number, the exponential number, the bigger the number is, the closer to zero it gets. Is that right? But you never get to zero. But what math am I using? I'm using normal math. Because there's no other kind of math. So when you go back to zero, you can't get there because our math has to take us there. So what new formulas were derived from the Big Bang, or what formulas show a gradual organization of disorganized material? What are the new discoveries, formulas, laws that have been harnessed against the degenerating laws of thermodynamics? All the laws we know, things go from order to disorder. Somewhere there's got to be a law that says from disorder we're going to have order. Now, if there's a law like that, it's in God's hands and he's not released it yet. And you know, it may be in the millennium that will be released. I don't know. We don't know. That's a guess. But it certainly isn't here. And evolution doesn't produce the formula to make this happen or the math to make it happen. Now, remember Mr. Osborne last week in that front page of New York Times said about evolution. He said, we are now in a position with great confidence to predict with great confidence not only what the various branches of this tree of life will be, but where they will be most likely to be found. And by the way, we were talking about the Nebraska man, which had been discovered in 1922, and they now were so excited. Now, Mr. Osborne went out on a limb over here, making a claim that it was a anthropoid fossil, which was a tooth of a pig, actually. But he didn't believe that. He was, you know, stuck his reputation, stuck his neck out on it. This is a first anthropoid we got, and it came from Nebraska, from the backyard of William Jennings Bryan's backyard, sort of, in Goth's Bluff area. It's a joke. But here he's got this great confidence. I'm waiting here 100 years later, and there's not one more of the branches, spaces been filled in. And so when we don't teach our kids evolution, they can't advance in science. Doesn't make any sense, does it? Unless it means you can't get into a school, but that's nothing to do with science. So this is Nebraska Ape Man in the Western World. This is dated September 11, 1922. I couldn't read it, blurred here. Scientists construct million-year-old link from truth found near Bryan's former home, first evidence of anthropoid in the United States. And it ended up being a pig. And why does it always have to be in Nebraska that we look so stupid? Well, it's, isn't it ash, no, agate beds in, huh? Ash, no, the Scotts Bluff area. The agate beds, they call them. Yeah, close to, close there. I'm not sure where the pig, but I know they found fossil. There's a little, they have a little park there. You can go up and look at their bones, and all the bones, by the way, are all in a jumbled up mess, which is different than asphalt. Asphalt, they're all organized. Only place in the world, folks, that's in Nebraska, by the way, that you can see bones are not disorganized. They're still in the way they were died. Now, we don't know that. That's impressive. That's impressive. Everywhere else, they're in a box. You know, the head bone tucked to the head bone. You know, they're in a box. That's where they are at the agate beds, too. They're all messed up. So you can't even see an animal. They're just, well, see, that's this kind of animal's leg, and that's this kind of forearm, whatever. But in the asphalt at Royal Nebraska, they're intact. Anyway, that no place in the world. So no one knows about that much anymore. Okay, we're still talking about this contribution of evolutionary knowledge. How can chance produce anything? It cannot even produce a right angle. Now, if you were a diver off the coast of Japan, and you came across what I see down here, and you look at that, and someone says, wow, what an accident. First thing a guy's going to say, hey, look at this. Somebody's been here and made this. How would you know that? Answer's on the board. But how would you know that? The right angles. Evolution can't even make a right angle. There are no right angles found in nature. I mean, you might find an angle for a little bit, but look at this. You don't find this in nature. You might find it, you know, along a layer of rock that's broken off, but right angles do not occur naturally. So when you see that happen, you know right away somebody's been here and made this. And they don't know who did this. Well, this, to me, it's really easy if you're a flood guy. This was before the ocean. Well, the ocean has risen, by the way, and it's called the ice melt from the caps. It's risen probably at least 200 feet. And this was built before it rose, which they had plenty of time to do that on the shelf, the continental shelves. So they call it a mysterious 10,000-year-old underwater ruins of Japan. All I'm showing this to you is it's not a random thing that happened. Somebody did it. And anything else that makes any sense, has any order to it, you know man had something to do with it. So what is missing if the student does not get evolution instruction? All the students of evolution really gets is skepticism, frankly. He gets despair. He gets no answers. He's got every reason to give up. Become a homeless person. Why not? Well, there's a connection. Surely he gets no answers. For answers, he needs predictable, repeatable formulas that always come out the same way. All scientists will have to wittingly or unwittingly depend on God of creation for his grand information. Whereas the physical world created by a loving, caring, faithful God is counted on, is dependable, is true, is useful. What is crippled? That's not the right word here. Well, may I use it? I'll use it. What is crippled if evolution is not taught? What's hurt when evolution is not taught? No scientist alive will depend on luck to work out his experiments. grabbing an energized electric line will always have the same result. The results from natural law. No one expects to be exempt from electricity by luck. Those are laws that exist, and they're from our Creator. And we thank Him for that, because we know that when that line lays there, and I know people have been electrocuted, even trying to save another person, they touch him and they're the one that is grounded, they died, the other person was just a conductor, they lived. I mean, we're talking about serious law here. Now, we get this from our Creator. We don't get this from evolution. So we have evolution as a toothless tiger. And it's a deadly parasite sapping the truth out of reality. That's the danger part. So you ever ask a student, what is it from evolution that you have learned? Well, we know how we got here. Okay, now how do you plug that into a formula? So the futility of legal solution. This is the next one. I don't think I have that order up there. The lesson last week I said, now this is, I taught this a few years ago. So I'm still testing this to see if this is correct. The lesson is that if grassroots Christians influence, simply by their presence, that is their normal living, talking to normal neighbors, saying normal things as Christians do, does not stop the advance of the unrighteousness, or the unrighteous, a state law will do nothing except antagonize the opposition. Now, we had in our own church a round of this, if you remember the Bennetts, lovely people in our church, Chuck and Bev, now they've got kids that are, what are they, 50s, something like that, okay? Huh? Well, speaking of, okay, now remember, this talking about laws here now. Remember, Soap's Trials was an attempt to pass a law. Remember the valiant effort in the 80s, probably started in the 70s, I'm not sure exactly where, and by the way, this all went by memory, so I may be corrected on some of this stuff. By the Bennetts in our church, blessed people, wonderful people, to get the church, the schools, to consider allowing teaching of creationism or not teach evolution. I forget exactly what it was. Maybe some of you remember. So I know they worked at trying to elect school board members so they could change the drift of what was going on in the schools, but the effort had made no progress. Probably antagonized some people. But it did encourage the homeschool movement. If you say there's something positive came out, that is true. And this homeschool movement still meets here at Lincoln every year for their annual convention. That's largely due to the Bennetts. So nothing happened out of that in terms of the law. This minor, not minor, but other thing came out of it. And there's also a pastor near Louisville, Nebraska, that engaged the courts, but he also made little effort. Anybody remember him? Everett Sullivan. That's right. And I know about the time, without looking at my notes, it was about 1980 when we were building our larger auditorium and I was playing racquetball. And I'd come back and have my donut and Mr. Donut on O Street and I'd get the USA Today paper and I'd read about Nebraska and the court trial about Everett Sullivan in it. Here we go again, a famous person in Nebraska. By the way, the only place that I know of that a church was ever padlocked was in Nebraska over this issue. So Everett Sullivan, 1984, Faith Baptist Church, Louisville, Nebraska, which is east here, right? Off of 34. He said, Nebraska has been a horror story in our nation for a long time. I don't know when he wrote this. In 1980, the Amish were prosecuted, even though the Yoder case is in good standing. They were fined, they refused to pay the fine. The state confiscated their buggies, sold them at public auction rather than fight. The Amish moved. Several years of intense struggle, the battle was finally won by Faith Baptist Church when Nebraska legislature changed the laws allowing churches to conduct schools unapproved by the state. And later on, I don't know, later on, maybe in the same package, they allowed families to educate their own children, which is the homeschooling movement came out of it. And Nebraska was not the only one that has done that. I think it's probably nationwide now that that can be done. And if you want to hear about the story, I've got the information here. You can look it up. He's now living somewhere else, even changed his name. It's tough stuff. It ought not seem uncommon for educational laws of the state to be driven by ideological motivations. You know, thinking from a humanistic standpoint, the unity of man, for example, we are in this together. We don't, you know, depend on God for anything. He's not going to interfere with our work. It's up to us, if there is a God. and the danger that children can be taught apart from the parents. There's a good chance that the education will prevail over what's taught at home, since many homes are not schools and the minds of the children are easy to shape. Now, when our kids came home and they said something that wasn't right, we had a discussion. It was always at the table, and it wasn't like at devotion times. It was whenever it came up. I think you have to do it with the kids. So I just put this up. I spent some time making this up, and I wasn't going to use it, but I just put this up anyway. I said, remember that when you get into the politics, like passing laws, you have to join common cause with other people. You just can't do this by yourself. And so when you do this, you get involved with people that don't believe like you do, but you believe agree on this one issue. And with it comes a lot of other baggage. And that's always been difficult for me to, what do? You know? And I'm not saying you shouldn't. It does depend a little bit on the issue. I was thinking exactly, an example would be a zoning law might be an issue. I might join with somebody else. If someone wanted to build a filling station next to my house, I might say, let's get our neighbors together and fight that as zoning law. But that's kind of more easy to understand that involvement is about this issue. But you get into ideological things, it becomes more difficult. So I'm just saying that it's not that easy to sort this stuff out. Because what's tempting is we do have a truth that we share that does not save. I got that in the middle. And then we have the truth that saves that's on the other side, which is not at all related to the person that's not saved. So we have this one little area that has nothing to do with, has done something to do with truth, but not that truth that saves. It's truth, like math. You can all agree that we can do math together. So anyway, it just becomes a difficult place to do something in cooperation and pass laws. It's just difficult. I think Bennett's probably understood that, found that to be true. Second issue in the Scopes trial was that there was a weak witness here. Second tactical errors to select a weak biblical witness. This mistake in the trial of the century was for a biblicist to give on the ground of false science. He shouldn't have given on that. He should have held his ground. In 1925, Christians were ill-equipped, I have to admit. While the evolutionists were sharpening their teeth, the evangelicals were dulling their Bibles to accommodate deep time, rather than fight back with their Bibles to give in to it. Evangelicals lost 200 years of discovery, I believe. It was not until Henry Morris and John Whitcomb's book, Genesis Flood, 1960, or 59, 60, somewhere in there, the confidence in the Bible was restored in the area of science, and that it was also trustworthy in a matter of touching on science. The worldwide flood and creationism go hand in hand. It was a book about flood, but you can't avoid creationism when you're talking about this world. While their book dealt with the flood, it explained much of what we see in the pre- and post-flood world. It had implications on the origins of the earth. Now, Brian was a compromised moralist. I do not think he was a fundamentalist theologically. He was a fundamentalist moralist who equivocated on clear statements of Scripture. Brian will claim the authority of Scripture but gives away to pseudoscience when he abandons a young earth. Now, we have to admit the dates in Genesis are sometimes difficult, but Brian accepted deep time rather than the creation criteria around 4000 BC, which showed his lack of confidence in Scripture. Now, James Usher, English guy, proposed the time we generally use for young earth, something like 4000 BC. So he died 1656. So Brian should have had that information available to him. You know, I'm saying getting these dates sometimes are hard. But Usher did it, and it's still pretty much the standard if you're going to take a young earth approach to time. So Usher proposed a still accepted reason time. It was available to Brian, but not convinced by the Bible. Brian partly followed science. The claim to the Bible as his authority was overruled or overturned when he abandoned its literal meaning. Darrell picked this issue to ridicule Brian. Even though Brian could make a good case for creationism, he lost moral ground when he gave up the part of the Bible that seemed wrong to him. You just can't give part of it up. You got to stick with it. That's my issue with the covenant people. They give up part of the Bible, and I should like that. Okay, take a breath. Okay, the end of the unified Northern Baptist. And then we have the end of the unified Presbyterians. I'll explain that a little bit. But we're going to go now into these churches starting to split, the denominational fragmentation. Now, the end of the Northern Baptist. Okay, as the tension between the skepticism affirmation groups grow, it fractured the denominations. The Northern Baptists, I think we call them the American Baptists. But no chart ever tells you everything you want to know. So Northern Baptist fractures off the GARBC, which is the General Association of Regular Baptist Churches, which is that Randolph and 50th and Randolph? Okay. There's one church that I know is in town, so we call them GARB Church. You got the initials. Dispensational Church. Over the years, been a good church. We have Darren Fry, teaches at Cedarville. There's a school in Cedarville, Ohio. Dispensational school, as far as I know, yet. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. That group came off of the New American Baptist. Want to talk about them yet? Not yet. We may never talk about them because I know where to put them.
Well, they go right there.
They go right here, right. I was thinking of another one, the General Baptist. I don't know where to put the General Baptist. Okay, so up here we have the Northern Baptist Convention, which we just talked about, and it looks like they start in the middle air, but the first Baptist church in America was started by? That's right, Roger Williams in? That's right. Providence, Rhode Island, we were there. And we have never heard a more liberal message than in that church, what year that was. So I don't know where they actually start, because you have to go, it was 1639 that started. So they were off the map here with the First Baptist Church. Remember, the Baptists come out of the Anabaptists. They dropped the Anna, the adult baptism group. So in 1932, we have the General Association of Regular Baptists. I just talked, that's the GARBC church. Yeah, right, 1932. And then one you mentioned, Pete, is in 1940. A little bit later, the Conservative Baptist Association splits off of the Northern Baptist Convention. Now, there is also a General Baptist. I don't know where they fit because they don't show on this map. But I'm sure they fit somewhere. They're probably more Arminian because of their name General rather than the other kind that are particular Baptists, although these aren't necessarily five-pointers. All right, so that's split there. Now, this gets more difficult, and you can't read this, but we have the Northern, this is Northern Baptist Convention, the Central Associated Regular Baptist, and then the Conservatives over here. I guess that is the same map. Then we have all the other ones that come over this. We have the Southern Baptists over here, and we have the Seventh-day Adventist Baptist over here, the Free Will Baptists. You know, I wonder if they're Calvinistic. So anyway, so we have a lot of Baptists that fragment. And by the way, fragmentation in churches is often looked at as a negative, only in the sense of humanism, because humanism needs them to be together. God looks at them, it's better they're not together. You know, so when you see these in-church fights, necessarily aren't always bad. Now, this is one I thought we were going to. It's the Presbyterian one. And the Presbyterians have a lot of sheep in the field here, too. So you have Presbyterians over here in 1706, but we're mostly, and that pretty well comes through, but we got some other jumps in and out. But this is the one that we're probably interested in. This is the one that divided, and out of that came the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Then we had the Bible Presbyterian Church. By the way, some of you old-timers, remember the Orthodox Presbyterian and Bible Presbyterian, they actually went together eventually. Right, that was one of them that's Orthodox. So these are small churches. So these are not big Presbyterian churches. So what we have, like with Stu Kearns' church on Zion, that would be this one here. So in a sense, it's related, but you got to go back here to pick it up. So when you say Presbyterian, you got a lot of Presbyterian churches to pick from here. So we're talking about the one that split. We're talking about, at this time, we're talking about these conservative churches split off of the main, this Presbyterian. Okay, I'm just pointing out there's others and there's stories, horrendous stories, I mean, bone-chilling stories behind these divisions because they had the conferences and they had manipulations and their politics like you do in any politics. And the property always was an issue. Who gets the property and who gets to control it and all that kind of stuff. And I mentioned that again a little bit here. So they're really exciting, in a sense, stories to go through, but I don't want to take the time to do it unless there's something comes that would be worthwhile doing. So many denomination churches have histories of fracturing, just said that. The result, nearly without exception, was that the liberal element being more worldwide and determined end up with the assets of the denomination. I don't know the exception to that. Well, I do have one. When the Southern Baptists had their fight with a guy preached here, was the head of the conference for a couple of years, H. Patterson, thank you, actually took over the conference. He actually pulled back the conference towards a conservative view. And I don't know if anybody else except the Lutherans, they had a group that was pulled back by Price. Tejan was a guy that went liberal, and this was back in the 70s. So there are a couple, I guess we could say, that they might have pulled back from liberalism. But generally, once the argument goes on in the church, the conservatives either withdraw or they don't fight like the world does and they lose it. So the liberals are wise not to start enough. They're not, I mean, wise is kind of a word like this. They're wise not to start their own churches or schools, but are content to steal the existing ones. And Gill's made that point a number of times. You don't have to start schools, you just take over old existing ones. The fundamentalists are not as good at offense or defense fighting, give in due to Christian charity perhaps, are simply outsmarted by the liberals sometimes, who suggest appointing a committee to look into the matter. And then this is really what happened. And a year later, they said, what was the issue again? Oh, well, let them do it. And it's over. Or they table an action till next time or next day, or, you know, they forget about it. So they delay and obfuscate. But we look at it and say, well, all, for God, all is not lost. It's probably better to start over anyway. So the end of fundamentalism was given by the moderates. They said, it's over. After the Scopes trial, they're done. However, fundamentalism was not disappearing. It was realigning, reestablishing without any modern resistance. See, when they're gone, you can do what you want to do. So in some sense, it's good to get rid of them. I'm speaking colloquially. Okay. Better in the long run. Not being able to control either the major northern denominations nor the popular political culture, fundamentalists continue to do what they did best, evangelize and build local churches. They just started over again without all the baggage of trying to drag these guys along that wouldn't agree. For evangelism, they long had been masters of the mass media, and so adapted quickly to radio. And I point out that the old-fashioned revival hour started in 1925 with Fuller. And there were others, so they did a great job under the wires. And no one's really paying attention to them. They always thought they were gone, but here they're coming along with other stuff. Locally, their individual churches, the agencies grew, even if it slowed by the financial pressures of the Depression of the 30s. Some fundamentalists separated into their own churches, which I saw with the Gabeline, while other conservatives quietly remained in their major denominations, at least for now, and some of them eventually did leave. Okay, now I'll have more of this next week. I want to kind of go through some of that stuff, what actually happened there. Okay, we'll do one more here. The existential threat of the Soviet communism with Lenin. Remember, Lenin came to power in 1917, October, the Second Revolution in Russia. First one is the White Revolution. The second was the Red Revolution. 6 months apart, Revolution in Russia. The second was a bad one. And the issue of the place of nationalism, that's American nationalism, with God and country, and America being a, quote, chosen nation, which is a little stretch for me. Say that. So the existential threat of the Soviet Union and the place of nationalism, that is God and country. Now, there's another issue that comes into play at the end of the World War I, and the aftermath of the trial. The fundamentalists were early to spot the threat of the ideology of Marx and of Lenin in Russia. Marx was 1850, I'd say. He already died, but Lenin's picking up this good stuff, socialism. The USA entered the, by the way, socialism was a new idea. No, that, there wasn't any social countries that you could look to and say, look at how they failed. They just, oh, well, wow, that looks pretty good. No want, no trouble, what, you know, nobody fighting over property. You know, for some mind, it might sound good. So the United States entered the war late, April 17, were in it for about a year, as the Soviets under Lenin backed out of the war, withdrew forces in the German conflict. But Russia, the second revolutionary Russia, was an avowed atheistic regime. Stalin comes to power after Lenin's death in 1924, probably in a couple of years. The fundamentalists were likely more threatened by Lenin and Stalin's atheism than their Marxism, although I'm not sure I want to argue that a long time because they were really, really afraid of communism. And it was also mostly related to their atheism. So was it the communism they worried about or was it atheism? I'm not sure. So Russia became the foe of the American Christianity. This dual alliance will mark the fundamentalists, the God and country, plus openly anti-Catholic, because America was the Protestant nation. And all of a sudden, we have all these Catholics coming in from Ireland, from wherever else, not necessarily refugees, but they were coming from, and they were sort of changing things, and that really concerned the fundamentalists. We've got to mention another Billy here. Billy Sunday, we must mention him. He 1862 to 1935. Some equated Christianity and American completely, equated them together. Christian Americanism is the same thing. Christianity and patriotism are synonymous terms, said evangelist Billy Sunday directly. Hell and the traitors are synonymous. Pretty stout stuff here. Sunday was just at the height of his fame when the World War I broke out, and he incorporated the war in his message with extravagant enthusiasm. Of all the major American evangelists, such as Finney, Moody, Sunday, Graham, Billy Sunday was the greatest showman. An ex-baseball player, his sermons were filled with acrobatics, there we go. Jumping, falling, whirling, and sliding. And I see pictures of him doing this stuff, ending up on his message standing on the pulpit. If that doesn't get your attention, I don't know what will. Oh, it would become difficult and hard to separate the healthy Christianity and American patriotism. After all, we are taught to obey the government. We should be patriots in Romans 13. That America is exceptional and without equal is irrefutable, but exactly what does that mean is somewhat of a mystery, and I say even to me. There was confusion with the dispensation. There was no confusion with dispensationalists regarding Israel as the chosen nation. Yet there's something about America that wants to claim a Christian heritage. This is recognized by the fundamentalist and still lingers on in our minds, or the minds of many, and disdained by the left who want to remove any Christian markings in the nation. Now, I tell you, that is more of a sign to me, a clue to me that God does have his hands, his hooks into America. Because it's the resistance that people have against the country now from the left. They want, in a sense, to destroy it. They want to destroy the Christianity. That's what they want to destroy. So then God is doing something here. Because why would he want to be against it? All right? So I think there is something here, but I can't explain it. For these people, many would sing God Bless America as quickly as they would sing Amazing Grace. It has been in the recent decades that this alliance has found newfound threats from the secular left who detest anything appearing Christian. Have you noticed that? How to hang on to the great heritage of the past but not violate the factors of trusting God in all things remains a challenge for our generation. So I have one map over here with the flag of Christ, cross, church, up, and the state flag below it, and then we have one, the state flag at the top, and so which is the right way to do this? Okay, I'm just wondering if I want to stop here. Yeah, we'll leave it. Yeah, we've got a couple more here. So a sharp contrast can be drawn between the fundamentalists and the modernists in this God and country thing. The fundamentalists were concerned about God and the gospel continuing in America. I'm not sure totally healthy about what they thought about it. And elsewhere. The modernists were concerned that America would be safe for democracy, meaning that the morals would need to be here to control the passions, because without morals, no America. That is, they're talking about half of Christianity. But they were losing ground on this point as the days of the Prohibition fostered crime and loose living of the 20s. The fundamentalists were concerned with keeping God and gospel in America, but they were more likely to assess the real threat of political communism. Many fundamentalists, radio preachers, saw the rise and spread of the Soviet Union and atheistic communism and preached the gospel as they exposed the Reds. Sometimes you don't know what you're listening to, a political speech or a Christian speech. The political left was enamored with the likes of Uncle Joe Stalin, and the fundamentalists saw through the charade. In the end of 1989, the Soviet Union collapsed, but until then, they were an existential threat, even in the Western Hemisphere. Remember the Cuban crisis in the 60s. So for the time, so for any time, the left in America was also supportive of the anti-Semitism of Nazis. In other words, they were on the wrong side of this issue. IBM, for example, built a system of numbers that were used to number the Jews. Henry Ford published the protocols of the Zion's elders with joy. A confusing time, but relatively clear to the fundamentalists. They didn't join into that. So today, the existing communist states in the world are now down to five, China, Cuba, Laos, Vietnam. These communist states often do not claim to have achieved socialism. This is off of Wikipedia. Interesting, they don't claim to achieve socialism. Well, that's probably good because they haven't done anything with it yet. But just around the corner, it's going to be successful. Rather, they claim to building and working toward establishment of socialism in their countries. And I must add now, Venezuela. And I'm going to stop there. Fundamentalism dead? Question mark. I don't want to go into this, so we'll just leave that 3 minutes. So, got a couple of minutes. You got a comment or question?